Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Child Protection in Sport Unit. We're part of the NSPCC and funded by UK Sports Councils. Our work supports organisations to safeguard all children taking part in sport.
Hi and welcome everybody. We're here from the NSPCC and the Child Protection and Sport Unit, and we're going to be talking about community sport and physical activity. I'm really pleased that I've got three amazing guests on the show with us this morning. We've got Anita, John and Ross. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to let them introduce themselves first, and they can tell you a little bit about where they come from, what they do in their roles. So Anita, I'm going to come to you first, if that's all right.
Yeah, I'm Anita. I work for Active Norfolk, one of the active partnerships, and I'm really enjoying getting out into the community, supporting clubs and community organisations with their safeguarding.
Brilliant. That's great. Thank you so much for joining us, Anita. John, I'm just going to come to you next. If you can just introduce yourself and where you're from, what your role is.
Hi, everybody. I'm John Downs. I currently work for Free Games, working with what you might describe as the kind of underserved communities, areas of poverty around sport and physical activity as a tool to engage.
Brilliant. That's great. Thanks very much for that, John. Ross, coming to you next. So tell us a little bit about the organisation that you work for and what role you play in that.
Hello, everyone. My name is Ross Padima, and I'm the strategic director for Sporting Community. This is a DIC which has taken on board a lot of the sort of detachees work across Staffordshire and Derbyshire, and we deliver a lot of the programmes that sort of the doorstep programme that John spoke about.
Brilliant, that's great. So as people can hear, we've got wealth of experience. And maybe what we'll start with is about, like, what do you see some of the biggest challenges of running community sport and physical activity for children and young people? And how do you think your organisation tries to overcome these barriers and these challenges? And I think for all three of you on the call, you know, it's not just about your organisations, you work in partnership with other organisations. So maybe if we can bring that in the discussion. So Anita, I'll come to you first. Okay.
I think some of the biggest challenges for community projects and people working in that field is quite often their volunteers. Sometimes their confidence around safeguarding may not be there, and it's about supporting them to feel more confident and to be able to be curious about the people that they're helping. We're very lucky in Norfolk, we have a scheme called the Safer Programme, and they are there to support community projects. They offer training, help with safeguarding procedures, templates. When we've been involved in their holiday activity programme, HAF, one of the things we did when we commissioned that was to offer anyone who was going to provide for us, we would offer them a free place with the Safer Programme. From when we started 4 years ago to now, when I become involved in safeguarding and they're letting us know about what's happened, they're offering out support to families, signposting them to family hubs. Now, I don't think that would have happened 4 years ago, but they now see their role as to support, you know, the families they're working with. So that, I think it's fantastic to see that move and that confidence grow over the project.
Brilliant. That's great. Thanks for that, Anita. John, just coming to you, we need to just talk about the holiday activity fund that you're working with. What are some of the challenges that they're facing, and maybe some of the solutions that either Street Games have supported them with or those organisations have put in themselves?
When you first asked the question, when I think about the challenges, the word that comes to mind is complexity. For a community organisation, a sports organisation running activities, if they're in a holiday, there's a food programme, I suppose it's less straightforward, it feels, than it maybe used to be in terms of the challenges that you're dealing with young people and families. And also to run something that's a year-round offer, and that's what we try and promote with providers is, because yes, the holidays is important, but if they're looking at some of the most vulnerable kids, they're not just hungry in the school holidays, they're hungry all year round. What we see in the school holidays is that might intensify and might, the stress is increased on the family because there isn't the other support from the school. But for the providers, it's a more complex model of, how do you keep going for a year? And for the statutory sector, they're a vital cog in delivering delivering critical services. The statutory sector has to deliver services for those most in need, but it doesn't have the delivery itself to do it. So it relies on commissioning the voluntary community sector. And I've talked to DCMS a lot about organisations wearing different coats, the same organisation, but one day they're wearing the health coat, one day they're wearing the safer coat, one day they're wearing the sports coat. They're delivering to multiple outcomes to try and keep the wheels turning. Sport is a vehicle and tool to engage young people in that, because it's a popular offer for young people. It's something they want to do if delivered well, delivered right. For sports clubs, it's about them being able to diversify and think about what they can offer above and beyond just the pure sport offer if they want to be sustainable for a kind of longer term basis.
Honey, that's great. Thanks for that, John. Ross, I'm just going to come to you next. So we're hearing, you know, both Anita and John have talked about that voluntary and community sector, volunteers, confidence building. Is there anything else that you see as challenges specifically within this sector about community doorstep sport? And how do you think your organisations or your organisation overcomes them?
I think one of the things that I'm keen on doing, and what we do as an organisation, is do value-based interviews with all our volunteers and our staff. Recruitment is always a challenge because the pay isn't that good or consistent. And so getting the right people to work in those spaces with the values already built in is always very, very challenging. We can train and on skills, but the values are paramount, because we want our staff to go into those spaces and be able to react appropriately and accordingly to those young people's needs. You know, they're looking at those sort of triggers or those cues from children that there's a need for additional support. One of the most important things, I think, and challenges, because not every organization has got that kind of starting point. Mm-hmm. Critically, it is getting those people who can interview those staff and put that at the forefront of everything that they do. And even when we have a meeting to evaluate the project, is use safeguarding as the first bullet point that you talk about. So what you're trying to do is change a culture within any organization that safeguarding is the first and foremost. Before we actually get into the fun and game, pays and conditions are really important. You know, we have a lot of people who are volunteers who goodwill is their currency. We need to pay them proper wage, not just a living wage, a proper wage, and professionalize the organizations and give the workforce something to work towards, because that's been one of the problems that we have recruiting people. It's just not enough money to retain them.
Ross, Anita and John, there are some amazing things. And I think you're absolutely right. Let's get the right people in the right roles to work with children and young people. Because if we get that bit right, then hopefully all those other bits will slot into place. And it is about making sure that we're being child centred and that the welfare of children is at the heart and the value base of everything that we do. As you said, you know, that goodwill comes from people's passion and people's own intrinsic value. So thanks for raising that. Anita, did you want to jump in? I could do you.
Yeah,
I was in a way.
Yeah, I was nodding away. Yeah. It was just what John was saying about the most vulnerable, that we're supporting the most vulnerable. And certainly from my perspective and some of the providers I've worked with, some of the sole traders, when they've come in to, you know, provide for HAF, their first goal wasn't necessarily to support the community or for that reason. They were a sole trader. They saw that there was funding available. They worked in that field and they've stepped into that arena. So it's been really interesting watching them through their journey and supporting them through their journey. I worked with a fantastic provider in Norfolk who they were delivering in schools. You know, that was their main, you know, area of work. HAF has come along and they've built that into their business. They've really taken on safeguarding and welfare and well-being to the next stage. And, you know, I went along to watch some of their sessions. It was during Keeping Your Child Safe in Sport. And they were delivering to a young group. And they were talking about what makes you feel safe in sport. And they were doing it while they were playing basketball. So if they scored a basket, they were able to run over and write on the whiteboard. And kids love writing on whiteboards. Whatever, wherever you are. And they would run over and they'd write down on the board what made them feel safe, who made them feel safe. And it was just a fantastic to watch that journey for that provider who, went into it just because there was funding and they could run during the summer and through the holidays, to now, they run family-led dodgeball sessions. So that the children come, the parents come, and, I've been along to watch them, and they're just great. They're watching the whole family playing dodgeball. They have sessions that are in the dark with the glowing balls. And
it's amazing.
And it's incredible.
There's a big thing for me about the culture around safeguarding here when we think about providers. And there's lots of great examples of organisations, and we manage a half program in Birmingham, and that's about 250 providers. And we do regular safeguarding forums for them to come together and talk about safeguarding practice. And we get 30 to 40 turn up, which is brilliant, openly talking about safeguarding and the work they do. And my mind goes to, there's still another 200 who don't. And there's something about, we've done a lot of work looking at when we've given out big grant application programs to the Ministry of Justice, we started to see when organizations are answering questions about their safeguarding practices, what we found was there was a big, big chunk who are still in a very compliance-focused place. They take the path of least resistance to do, what do I need to do to get the funding to allow me to operate? Yeah. And things like half of a job in improving that, but organizations going, right, I've got a policy, I do my DBS checks, I've done some training, tick the box, I can operate. And we've got a job of moving that culture to what you were talking about, Ross, about thinking about that, where does safeguarding sit in the hierarchy of your organization? Actually, is it the thing at the end that you tick some boxes to do, or is it a fundamental practice? It's a commit. There's roles of commissioners, there's roles of local authorities, saying, well, what can we do at that phase to ask the questions of a provider to make them think differently?
Absolutely, John, I totally agree with you. And I think when I talk to organizations up and down the country, people are talking about the fact that when they're working in communities, that doorstep activity providers, people are scared of the word safeguarding because we see stuff in the newspapers, like big headlines and stuff, and people are really scared about it. So how do we try and create that culture, or how do we try and help and support those organisations to move from it being something really scary that's embedded within our culture?
Yeah.
And Anita, any thoughts from you?
Yeah, well, I think it's really interesting because my role, the sport welfare role, was to come in and support and enhance safeguarding within clubs. And I found when I've started that compliance conversation. And I remember one of the first clubs I went to, and I was telling them about my role and I was there to support them. And I arrived and there was a big long table with three folders all full of policies and procedures, and the lady said, where do you want to start? And I closed the folder and I said, definitely not there. Tell me about your club. Tell me about what it's like to teach these young people. How do you have conversations with them? And actually, we went on and we've done some work together. And as I've been working in this role for the last year, I kind of found it when I knocked on the door to say, I'm here to support you locally about safeguarding. The first thing they'd say is, yeah, we're fine with our safeguarding. We've got all our forms and we've done the course. Yeah. So, I went back and reflected on that and changed how I introduced myself and changed some of the things that I talk about welfare and talk about how do you engage with the young people? How do you communicate with them? I'm in more clubs are talking to me. And when I'm in there, then you can talk about the safeguarding things. Have you got a safeguarding board? How do how do they communicate with your club welfare officers? And it's been a really interesting journey over the last year.
Language is really important here. When I started my safeguarding role journey, I was in a national DPSU event, and actually the table was saying, we would do more safeguarding if we had more money. And I was like, that's not the right approach. And I said, well, what about player welfare? Well, player welfare is really important. We do that all the time.
Yeah.
So there's something about the culture and this language of shifting it, you're right, Anita, into how do we talk about that, maybe feel comfortable with it? Because welfare and well-being has a much warmer feeling to it as opposed to safeguarding. Yeah. And we've got to think about that with clubs and organisations, but we've got to make sure you get it right, because actually getting something about the welfare of a child wrong is possibly the most serious thing. And it's where it sits in the thinking of people. Yeah. You know, I often think of how much like safeguarding and welfare conversations and training is seen as something you do once every 3 years, not an ongoing CPD. So we've got to change the mindset of this is something we constantly talk about. We constantly do training on. It's connected in all ways. Because actually, you're good at safeguarding. You can be a really good coach and run a session really well. And we've got to think about it as a practice, not a tick box thing to do. And I think it all comes down to language and approach is the first point of this with people.
But, and I know, Ross, your organisation does a lot of work around listening to the voice of the children. And for me, it's about normalising that conversation, isn't it? Just about caring about people and making sure that people are all right. And just interested to hear about how your organisation brings in the voice of children and young people and, you know, those things like Play Their Way campaign about how they're really important to the organisations. As you said, John, to change that narrative from it being like this safeguarding thing that we do once every 3 years to actually it being something that's embedded in everything that we're doing. And it's just a way of caring for children and young people.
Yeah.
We run a My Voice and a Derby Yes programme, which is where we bring groups of young people into like little forums. And it's about sort of youth agency and how do we get these young people to change the narrative within their community? Have we got some resources that they can act upon and actually do a lot of the problem solving themselves? And it's about listening, giving young people responsibility within their own community. We as organizations have got to not just talk about it and create nice little mini councils. Have the courage to give our budget up to young people for them to make it mistakes, make wonderful decisions, but they have accountability and they take it on board. But we protect young people from that process. One of the things that drives our work and the young people actually shape our services. So they're steering up, not the other way around.
I love that. I love that idea and that. And I know, John, Street Games have been doing quite a lot of work in that space as well. You had your youth manifesto and you're in the build to the election and stuff, and about, you know, listening to Ross there talking about like changing that narrative where young people can kind of be leaders in that space as well, being peer coaches and problem solving and taking that responsibility, but also creating that safe space where young people can make mistakes, but being able to be supported by adults that we trust. And that's really valuable, isn't it?
You know, it comes down to the conditions, the environment you create. You know, young people are told there's lots of opportunities to shape things, but it's not in the right environment and the right mechanism. So Ross mentioned youth councils and parliaments. There is structure that have been there for ages, but we often challenge are they representative and engaging for young people who, particularly where decisions are made about them in some of the communities and some of the most vulnerable. It's like, we need to hear from those young people. The environment needs to be suitable for them to share their views, be heard, be listened and be supported. So there's an environment that organisations create and the mechanisms. Quite often we also create adult structures saying young people want to form a council or committee. I don't think many adults want to be on councils or committees, but we still got, let's create a council or a committee. So and he wants to become a chair and a treasurer and it's like, but so we've got to stop trying to create adult structures. And for some young people, the way to shape something is a conversation with a trusted adult. They don't want to be leading something. It's empowering to say, go as far as you want to go. The job of an organisation is to create the opportunity to stay. If you want to have a budget and shape something, brilliant, we're going to create the opportunity. But for some young people, that's too far, too scary. But even sharing their views with somebody to say, I want to do these things, I'm concerned about this, that's that child-centered coaching approach. It starts there. It's about a range of opportunities for you to pick and choose, and you'll have different young people at different points. I think it can be done. We have to approach it of create the right environment for young people to have the space to share their views. That's therefore about the staff leading it. Ross is right. Usually the staff who have been young people leading it are really good at doing it again. So can we create that chain of development? From my experience, when it's done badly, it's seen as, a compliance thing to do to say, right, we've listened to some young people, that's done.
Yeah.
We're still going to do something, but we can at least say we've listened to some young people because their ideas are something we can't do anyway because we haven't got the budget. So you go back and go, why did you ask them in the first place?
Absolutely. And I think using things like the Lundy model, I think that is really where people should be at. And I think that is the benefit of thinking about youth work and sport and physical activity coming together, because there's those amazing skills and assets that the youth sector has that maybe is not necessarily prevalent within the sport community. What role sport and physical activity can play in engaging those young people who maybe, you know, don't see that sport for them and maybe going down the wrong path. How can we use sport and physical activity as a diversion technique to get young people to maybe think about valuing themselves, being part of the solution rather than feeling disaffected by society and by the community?
I suppose, Lisa, it comes back to the same thought process of engaging young people in spaces where they're at. And this takes persistence and it's harder work. It's not more complex, but it's harder because you've got to go back and again and again and again. And sometimes, you know, when it comes down to doing something around getting the views of young people, I used the term before, people want the easiest path to take. So actually, we'll send a survey out and we've got the views of 50 people on a survey, 100 people on a survey. Well, are they the right 100 young people? Or actually, who is giving you the informed choice? So, you know, we've worked with a few governing bodies in the past who have youth councils or youth boards, and they're made up of people who love the sport and are very good at the sport. And then you go, right, well, they're trying to give you viewpoints on how young people who don't like their sport to play their sport. And that doesn't connect, does it? Because they love that sport. So you've really got to challenge, and this is where, with any of this work, who are you speaking to and where do you go to engage them? And actually, the first stage, therefore, is about building the relationship with the young person before you're thinking about the activity and what the outcome is. So within the safer space, data helps identify where those things are, and identifying the organisations and partners who are based in those communities to go and engage with young people. And those young people, if they're living in an area where crime and antisocial behaviour is higher, they're going to be more nervous about people coming talking to them. Quite often we focus on what we're trying to achieve as an outcome rather than the first stage of just got to build a relationship with the young people and build from there.
And Lisa, I can see that you want to jump in.
I was just wondering how you tackle that contextual safeguarding when you're in those spaces. Because if you're building trust, but you're in a space that there, you know, there may be some contextual safeguarding, I wondered how you tackled those.
So we've got a mobile youth box that we go out into those spaces. So it creates that safe space on their pad, and it's got all the resources within that. But in addition to that, we have a family support team that actually we bring into those spaces when we find out there's much more going on. The immediacy of what we've witnessed needs an intervention. And so that's why we've created that. But we actually go into the hearts of the communities and be visual. And what's really interesting is the response from the community, the parents in those communities, because they feel reassured that their young people needs to be met. It's about not just the young people, it's about the wider community that we communicate with and build the trust with them as well.
I think as well, Anita, there's elements of different agencies involved in this, you know, utilising data and understanding to know what the community's like before you might, you know, when you're going to do it. So actually, what are the issues that are in that community? What skills and experience do we need? What understanding do we need? Who else needs to know that somebody's going to might be turning up and doing some activity in a park on that space? Is it that the police are not there, but the police are aware that there's support available? So you build that wraparound. It's utilising all the data and evidence is there. And we know all that information. Let's use it and equip the right people. But also that dovetails funding together, actually, because the community safety team and the police, they know they're all interested in the same areas and the same young people. So actually, we can increase the resource collectively. I think the other thing is about that safe space. It's then helping young people identify where that safe space is. And it might be that you can move a group, as Ross said, you might have a bus, or you could move a group because they want to be in a building. They're hanging in the park outside. Years ago, we did some work in Durham where we turned the lower level of an Asda car park into the youth club because that's where they all work. So suddenly get the lights on and it was covered and there was food there. You essentially had a youth club without walls, but it was where they wanted to be. Yeah. And you built, and suddenly the PCSOs would drop in, the youth workers would drop in, and suddenly you had a safe space where they could talk and be, but they were already there. But we knew it was the space because we had the data.
Yeah. It's so lovely to hear that innovation that's happening across the country. And I think people being brave enough to go and meet young people where they're at and work with multiple agencies to engage with young people in that holistic services. So just think that that was fantastic to hear about that.
One of the things that just occurred to me when I was speaking is about sharing data and information.
That certainly happens during the summer. You know, if providers, they might have, they've got any concerns, but, you know, is that message going back to the school? So when that child goes back in September, you know, there may have been something that's happened during that holiday and the school might not be aware because they haven't been able to share that data because they're perceived as they're just a leisure provider.
The children's wellbeing and schools bill left coming in.
They're
going to be included in schools as one of the safeguarding partners. So hopefully that'll take away that barrier because I think you're absolutely right, Anita, that whole sport and physical activity have got that knowledge, that insight, that data of children and young people about what's happening over the summer holidays. That needs to be shared somewhere. And I think people quite often feel like, I can't share that because of data protection. And we know that that's not a barrier. It shouldn't be a barrier to people sharing concerns that they've got.
Information sharing and recording issues is at the heart of it. I do think there's organisations who don't report and record things because they don't have the mechanism to do it. It's not easy to do. So we're missing a picture of some of the smaller things, I think, that go on. We use a system called Toot that they've used in education. We use the sports side of that for our staff, but that's app-based. So when we've got residentials and things, people can use the phone and record it instantly on an app, and it's all secure and logged in. It's brilliant that way.
It goes back to that professionalism we were saying at the beginning.
Absolutely.
That, you know, that we can be trusted as professionals to record that and our view is important, and, you know, what we're seeing on the ground is important. And, you know, if we're just given bits of paper, you know, it doesn't really elevate our role or people in clubs and communities who, you know, their opinion, we have to start believing their opinion and trusting them.
I think for me, one of the good things that we could do as organisations and promote is the NSPCC helpline. So as you were saying, Ross, people might not feel confident enough to be able to raise those concerns because they're trying to build those relationships. But they know that by raising concerns, which people have to do to look after children, could also destroy a relationship. So utilising the NSPCC helpline as well, people can make anonymous referrals into them and they will then risk assess it and share that information with statutory agencies who will pick up on those referrals coming through to the local authority. So I think that's one mechanism that people use.
Things that we've done that I think have really helped us and work. One, we give our staff little cards that sit in their wallet with the phone number and helplines and just in simple reminders, demystify the whole policy process. That the moment something happens, you think, well, can I read my whole policy? No, the five key bullet points of what you need to do, it sits in your wallet. You can take it out with you. It's been really helpful. We use our CAT kind of thing. We talk about change, act, tell. So we talk about if you see a change in behavior, change, we use the word change that any issue you have, act upon it, make sure you tell the right person. And then the number on the back will have my number. If I'm not available, you could ring the NSPCC or ring the police. It's basically, and it's in your wallet to say, if you forget, pick that up, read it, and you might ring one of these numbers. Safeguards about how you run your session and how you talk to young people and how you lead by example. And then it's the bit at the end of it is spotting something and telling the right person about it.
One of the things that we've talked about is like that reporting process and what adults can do. I think also what adults can do to support children and young people is signpost them to Childline as well.
Yeah.
Because obviously that's a free confidential service that young people can go to. And it comes back to what you were saying earlier on, Ross, about empowering young people to make their own decisions as well. So one of the things that Childline will do is help and raise awareness with young people about what their experience and who they can go to talk to. Just before we're kind of wrapping up, because we've had amazing conversations, but maybe just one thing that you would recommend. So Ross, I'll come to you first. One thing that you'd recommend that people put in place in their club or organisation to safeguard children and young people?
I think it's on process. It's put that as the headliner topic for every conversation that you have, whether it's in a meeting, it's on an agenda. Put safeguarding first.
Brilliant. Love that. Put safeguarding first. Definitely. Participants at the part of everything that we're doing should be embedded in it and fantastic.
I think following that theme, when I thought about this question, it was about the environment. We've got to have the right environment for young people to participate in activities and feel safe. So we for me, it's about that safeguarding culture or the culture of the organization. Tool we use, in fact, some people call it the golden circle, or the start with the why thing of saying, well, actually, if we think about why we're doing what we're doing, what is underlying principle about we want to create a safe environment for young people to play sport, then the how is the environment you create before you think anything about what you're going to do, before you think about the training and the systems and the policies, get those to bits. And then your policy will flow and the training you do will flow and the system you use to record will flow. Your language around safeguarding shifts and you put safeguarding at the top of your agenda and you talk about it openly and it's not a scary subject to you there. And then you can talk about what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is all, you know, if we're doing North Tech sport, we're doing movement, physical activity, anything in this sector, what we ultimately, or why should always be, we want to create an environment where young people are happy, they're healthy, they're thriving, they're feeling included. And if we've got that as our value base, then everything else should just slot in alongside that.
I went into an organisation and did a forum with some young people from a disability group in Norfolk. And we were asking them about what made them feel safe and what safeguarding meant to them. And a young person said, when I think of safeguarding, I think of folders, risk assessments and bits of paper. And then we asked, what makes you feel safe? She said, people make me feel safe. And from that, we came up with, let's move safeguarding from policies to people.
Definitely. I love that. And I think we were at a conference, and I think it might have been Paul Stewart that said that. He said, it's not policies that keep people safe, it's people.
Yeah.
And I think we should definitely have a framework in terms of helping us to know what the processes are. So we do need to have policies and procedures. Yeah. But ultimately, it's about the people that we've got in front of us. And again, that comes back to the earlier conversation around safer recruitment processes, having the right people in the right roles to look after the amazing young people that we work with. So thanks for sharing that one with us, Anita. Can I just say a big, massive thank you to Anita, John and Ross for just a rich, warm conversation around safeguarding, that wider safeguarding in community sport and physical activity. And thank you very much for everybody for listening. And hopefully this will help you on your safeguarding journey.
Thank you for listening to this Child Protection in Sport Unit podcast. If you're looking for more information and resources on safeguarding children in sport, please visit our website at thecpsu.org.uk.